Along the edges of the bay, she could see thousands upon thousands of vibrant yellow daffodils, all growing in the dappled shade of a birch grove. A breeze, carrying with it the sweet scent of summer, caused the flowers to flutter and dance. All about her a feeling of peace and tranquility ruled. The world she stood in now was unsullied by man's evil or malice. Here indeed was paradise. "It's beautiful," she said at last, her thoughts finally giving birth to her words. "The flowers, the colours, the scent, it's like breathing champagne." "You like it, madam?" A man aged about 80 was facing her. He was dressed in a black cloak and wore a half-smile upon his weathered features. He gazed across at the flowers. "I often come here," he said, "whenever the doldrums of depression fall heavy on my countenance."
"You're very lucky," said Polly. "We have to rely on Name That Fruit."
"Name That Fruit?
It's a quiz show, you know, on the telly."
"Telly?"
"Yes, it's like the movies, but with commercials."
He frowned at her without comprehension and looked at the lake again. "I often come here," he said again, "whenever the doldrums of depression fall heavy on my countenance."
"You said that already."
The old man looked as though he were awakening from a deep sleep.
"What are you doing here?"
"My husband sent me. My name is Polly Next."
"I come here when in vacant or pensive mood, you know."
He waved a hand in the direction of the flowers.
"The daffodils, you understand."
Polly looked across at the bright yellow flowers, which rustled back at her in the warm breeze.
"I wish my memory was this good," she murmured.
The figure in black smiled at her.
"The inward eye is all I have left," he said wistfully, the smile leaving his stern features. "Everything that I once was is now here. My life is contained in my works, a life in volumes of words. It is poetic."
He sighed deeply and added,
"But solitude isn't always blissful, you know."
He stared into the middle distance, the sun sparkling on the waters of the lake.
"How long since I died?"
he asked abruptly.
"Over 150 years.
"Really?
Tell me, how did the revolution in France turn out?"
"It's a little early to tell."
Wordsworth frowned as the sun went in.
"Hello," he muttered. "I don't remember writing that."
Polly looked. A large and very dark rain cloud had blotted out the sun.
"What do you..."
she began. But when she looked around, Wordsworth had gone. The sky grew darker, and thunder rumbled ominously in the distance. A strong wind sprang up, and the lake seemed to freeze over and lose all depth as the daffodils stopped moving and became a solid mass of yellow and green. She cried out in fear as the sky and the lake met, the daffodils, trees and clouds returning to their place in the poem, individual words, sounds, squiggles on paper with no meanings other than those with which our own imagination can clothe them. She let out one last terrified scream as the darkness swept on and the poem closed on top of her. Chapter 12. Spec Ops 27, The Literary Detectives. This morning, Thursday Next joined the Literatech office in place of Cromarty. I cannot help thinking that she is particularly unsuited to this area of work, and I have my doubts as to whether she is as sane as she thinks she is. She has many demons, old and new, and I wonder whether Swindon is quite the right place to try and exorcise them. From Bowden Cable's diary. The Swindon Spec Ops headquarters were shared with the local police. The typically brusque and no-nonsense Germanic design had been built during the occupation as a law court. It was big, too, which was just as well. The way into the building was protected by metal detectors, and once I had shown my ID, I walked into the large entrance hall. Officers and civilians with identity tags walked briskly amid the loud hubbub of the station. I was jostled once or twice in the throng and made a few greetings to old faces before fighting my way to the front desk.
When I got there, I found a man in a white baggy shirt and breeches remonstrating with the sergeant. The officer just stared at him. He'd heard it all before. "Name?" asked the desk sergeant wearily.
"John Milton."
"Which John Milton?" John Milton sighed.
496.
The sergeant made a note in his book.
"How much do they take?"
200 in cash and all my credit cards.
"Have you notified your bank?"
"Of course."
"And you think your assailant was a Percy Shelley?"
"Yes," replied the Milton. "He handed me this pamphlet on rejecting current religious dogma before he ran off."
"Hello, Ross," I said.
The sergeant looked at me, paused for a moment, and then broke into a huge grin.
"Thursday! They told me you'd be coming back. Told me you made it all the way to SO5, too."
I returned his smile. Ross had been the desk sergeant when I had first joined the Swindon Police.
"What are you doing here?" he asked. "Starting up a regional office, SO9 or something. Add a touch of spice to tired old Swindon."
"Not exactly. I've transferred into the Literatech office." A look of doubt crossed Ross's face, but he quickly hid it.
"Great,"
he enthused, slightly uneasily.
"Drink later?"
I agreed happily, and after getting directions to the Literatech office, left Ross arguing with Milton 496. I took the winding stair to the upper floor, and then followed directions to the far end of the building. The entire West Wing was filled with spec ops or their regional departments. The environmental spec ops had an office here, as did Art Theft and the Chronoguard. Even Spike had an office up here, although he was rarely seen in it. He preferred a dark and rather fetid lock-up in the basement car park. The corridor was packed with bookcases and filing cabinets. The old carpet had almost worn through in the centre. It was a far cry from the Literatech office in London, where we had enjoyed the most up-to-date information retrieval systems. At length, I reached the correct door and knocked. I didn't receive an answer, so I walked straight in. The room was like a library from a country home somewhere. It was two stories high, with shelves crammed full of books covering every square inch of wall space. A spiral staircase led to a catwalk which ran around the wall, enabling access to the upper shelves. The middle of the room was open plan, with desks laid out much like a library's reading room. Every possible surface and all the floor space were piled high with more books and papers, and I wondered how they managed to get anything done at all. About 5 officers were at work, but they didn't seem to notice me come in. A phone rang, and a young man picked it up.
"Literatech office?"
he said in a polite voice. He winced as a tirade came down the phone line to him.
"I'm very sorry if you didn't like Titus Andronicus, madam," he said at last, "but I'm afraid it's got nothing to do with us. Perhaps you should stick to the comedies in future."
I could see Victor Analogy looking through a file with another officer. I walked to where he could see me and waited for him to finish.
"Ah, next. Welcome to the office. Give me a moment, will you?"
I nodded, and Victor carried on.
"I think Keats would have used less flowery prose than this, and the third stanza is slightly clumsy in its construction. My feeling is that it's a clever fake, but check it against the verse meter analyzer."
The officer nodded and walked off. Victor smiled at me and shook my hand.
"That was Finister. He looks after poetry forgery of the 19th century. Let me show you around."
He waved a hand in the direction of the bookshelves.
"Words are like leaves, Thursday. Like people, really. Fond of their own society."
He smiled.
"We have over 1 billion words here. Reference, mainly. A good collection of major works and some minor ones that you won't even find in the Bodleian. We've got a storage facility in the basement. That's full as well. We need new premises, but the Literatechs are a bit underfunded, to say the least."
He led me round one of the desks to where Bowden was sitting bolt upright, his jacket carefully folded across the back of his chair, and his desk so neat as to be positively obscene.
"Bowden, you've met. Fine fellow. He's been with us for 12 years and concentrates on 19th-century prose. He'll be showing you the ropes. That's your desk over there."
He paused for a moment, staring at the cleared desk. I was not supernumerary. One of their number had died recently, and I was replacing him. Filling a dead man's shoes, sitting in a dead man's chair. Beyond the desk sat another officer, who was looking at me curiously.
That's Fisher. He'll help you out with anything you want to know about legal, copyright, and contemporary fiction.
Fisher was a stocky man with an odd squint, who appeared to be wider than he was tall. He looked up at me and grinned, revealing something left over from breakfast stuck between his teeth. Victor carried on walking to the next desk.
17th and 18th century prose and poetry are looked after by Helmut Beit, kindly lent to us by our opposite number across the water. He came here to sort out a problem with some poorly translated Goethe, and became embroiled with a neo-Nazi movement attempting to set Friedrich Nietzsche up as a fascist saint.
Herr Beit was about 50, and looked at me suspiciously. He wore a suit, but had removed his tie in the heat.
S of five, eh?
Asked Herr Beit, as though it were a form of venereal disease.
I'm SO27, just like you, I replied quite truthfully. 8 years in the London office under Boswell.
Beit picked up an ancient-looking volume in a faded pigskin binding and passed it across to me.
What do you make of this?
I took the dusty tome in my hand and looked at the spine.
The Vanity of Human Wishes, I read. Written by Samuel Johnson and published in 1749, the first work to appear in his own name.
I opened the book and flicked through the yellowed pages.
First edition. It would be very valuable if...
If? Repeated Beit. I sniffed the paper and ran a finger across the page and then tasted it. I looked along the spine and tapped the cover, finally dropping the heavy volume on the desk with a thump.
If it were real. I'm impressed, Miss Next, admitted Herr Beit. You and I must discuss Johnson sometime.
It wasn't as difficult as it looked, I had to admit. Back in London, we've got two pallet loads of forged Johnsonia like this, with a street value of over £300,000.
London, too! Exclaimed Beit in surprise. We've been after this gang for 6 months. We thought they were local.
Call Boswell at the London office. He'll help in any way he can. Just mention my name. Herr Beit picked up the phone and asked the operator for a number. Victor guided me over to one of the many frosted glass doors leading off the main chamber into side offices. He opened the door a crack to reveal two officers in shirt sleeves who were interviewing a man dressed in tights and an embroidered jacket.
Mallon and Soul look after all crimes regarding Shakespeare.
He shut the door.
They keep an eye on forgery, illegal dealing, and overtly free thespian interpretations. The actor in with them was Graham Huxtable. He was putting on a felonious one-man performance of Twelfth Night. Persistent offender. He'll be fined and bound over. His Malvolio is truly frightful.
He opened the door to another side office. A pair of identical twins were operating a large computing engine. The room was uncomfortably hot from the thousands of valves, and the clicking of relays was almost deafening. This was the only piece of modern technology that I had seen so far in the office.
These are the 40 brothers, Jeff and Jeff. The 40s operate the verse meter analyzer. It breaks down any prose or poem into its components, words, punctuation, grammar, and so forth, then compares that literary signature with a specimen of the target writer in its own memory. 89% accuracy. Very useful for spotting forgeries. We had what purported to be a page of an early draft of Antony and Cleopatra. It was rejected on the grounds that it had too many verbs per unit paragraph.
He closed the door.
That's all of us. The man in overall charge of Swindon Spec Ops is Commander Braxton Hicks. He's answerable to the regional commander based in Salisbury. He leaves us alone most of the time, which is the way we like it. He also likes to see any new operatives the morning they arrive, so I suggest you go and have a word. He's in room 28 down the corridor.
We retraced our steps back to my desk. Victor wished me well again, and then disappeared to consult with Helmut about some pirate copies of Dr. Faustus that had appeared on the market with the endings rewritten to be happy. I sat down in my chair and opened the desk drawer. There was nothing in it, not so much as a pencil shaving. Bowden was watching me. Victor emptied it the morning after Cromarty's murder.